Good afternoon. My name is Colby Synesael, and I'm the Communications Infrastructure and Telecom Services Analyst here at Cowen. Welcome to day one of Cowen's TMT Conference. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to introduce Jeff Solomon, who's the president of Cowen. He's going to speak for a few minutes to you about our business, and then what we're going to do is follow up with a fireside chat with John Donovan, who's the Chief Strategy Officer at AT&T. So with that, let me introduce Jeff.
Thanks, Colby. Okay, let's be really clear. You're not here to listen to me. But let's also be clear that, you know, we're feeding you. And so the cost of lunch is embedded in the 5 minutes you're going to give me while you're eating. And finish up on your food, because the next panel is actually, the next discussion is the one you actually want to hear. First of all, thank you all. I always feel like we don't do that enough in our business, is to thank people. There's obviously a bunch of other places where you could be today, and you've chosen to be here because you think there's going to be some value creation opportunities for you. And so our responsibility in that regard is to make sure that we deliver on that promise. And the fact that this is as well attended as it is, and I will tell you, New York is probably the hardest venue where we do conferences, because it's too easy for everybody to come for what they want and then run home, check the machines, and then come back. So when I see a room filled, especially at lunchtime, it suggests to me that the ecosystem that we're trying to create here, which is essentially its own TMT ecosystem where people can leverage off of each other's content, is effective. So I hope that you're taking the time today to be able to network and spend time with people who can help you to move the needles beyond just the Cowen presentation. I want to thank our friends from AT&T for coming and spending some time with us today. As you know, they probably get solicited by everybody to come to their conferences, so it's a huge kudos, for us and for Colby for them to be here today. So thank you. Also, thanks to the conference folks, who do an amazing job, really putting this on. It's no small feat. They do a great job. So here's what I want to leave you with. You've heard me talk over the years that this is all about, making a decision and a dedication to whether or not you're in favor of active management, not performance, or whether you aren't. I've talked about this title in the last three conferences. And I've asked you, how many firms in the street are 100% dedicated in all aspects of their business to outperformance, to the notion that alpha can still be created? It's a short list. And what we're trying to get done at Cowen is to deliver on the promise that if you look at the world as those who care about active management and outperformance, and those who don't, we're partners. So if you're thinking about this as the old buy side, sell side paradigm, I'm asking you yet again to relieve yourself or disabuse yourself of that notion. All right, we have a responsibility to each other to be moving the needle. If you're a company, it's all about being able to position you and your value creation proposition in the minds of capital providers and institutional investors who desperately need to pick winning stocks to outperform their cheaper brethren. Right? I've asked a group of children when they came in for back to school day, how many of you go to school every day to be average? No hands go up. I'm like, all right, so let me just be really clear. If you bring home a C on your report card, like, what does your parents say to you? And they're like, well, that'd be a bad day. I'm like, exactly, except every investor in America is like, hey, how do I just get the average? It's a real thing to think about. So in our view, this isn't just about positioning our brand in your mind. It's about delivering on the promise of that brand. And so as we look forward to 2018 and the adoption of something called MiFID II, and for those of you that don't know what MiFID II is, you're going to hear all about it. MiFID II is going to become the standard for the way that research is transmitted to the institutional equity community. It has a profound impact on the dollars that Wall Street firms will spend on the delivery of research, which impacts everybody in the entire ecosystem of active management. And it's coming to a theater near you in 2018. All right? As a result, very few firms are going to be investing in research because the research dollars spent will be less, probably, by the buy side than they were. And so our job is to make sure that we can continue to deliver high quality research and continue to deliver high quality trading and execution capability for our clients. Because at the end of the day, I actually don't care how you pay us as long as you do, if and only if we deliver. So it's no longer just good enough to be good, and it's no longer good enough to just be big or scaled. You have to be both. And at Cowen, we are. So tomorrow we close on our acquisition of Convergex, which for those of you that are portfolio managers, ask your trading desks. We will be one of the primary liquidity providers for you to enter and exit stocks. Fully independent, non-conflicted, agency execution globally. Because our responsibility to you is not just in the ideas that we promulgate here, but how those ideas get into your portfolios with as least amount of friction and as least amount of cost as possible. So as we continue to develop our business model here at Cowen, you're at the forefront of our minds, whether you're a company management or you're providing the capital to those companies, because without you, we don't get to do what we do. And I just wanted to, again, thank you, take a few minutes to express our sincere gratitude for everybody who's making the effort to be here today. So Colby, I'll turn it back over to you. Thanks, everybody.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. So as I mentioned, we're here with John Donovan, who's the Chief Strategy Officer of AT&T. John, I believe you have a few quick remarks as it regards to Reg FD, and then we can start.
You can sit for that.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I wanted to recognize our attorney's great work and reference the safe harbor statement. I'll be making forward-looking statements. So our SEC filings are on the website. If you have any questions, I'll direct you there.
Great. So I think what's really cool about having you here up on stage with me is that there's so many different areas that we could talk about that aren't just applicable to AT&T, but really the broader TMT space. So hopefully we'll get to a bunch of them today. But what I wanted to do is I did want to start off with the wireless network. And in wireless, we've entered an era of unlimited data, and AT&T specifically is focused on building that with content, including your DirecTV Now OTT video offer, as a way to differentiate yourself in the market. Can you help us get a sense what impact unlimited has had on your network and some of the things that you've done to try and ensure that the quality of the network experience doesn't suffer?
Sure. Our network has held up very well. The quality of our network, wireless network, has been great. But if you think about how we've deployed capacity, we have always tried to keep the invisible parts of the network, the ground-based network, well ahead of the capacity. And so for us, we always would deploy capacity a couple quarters in advance based on the trajectory of what we saw in the industry. And so, the factory size that we had was always based on what we forecasted the consumption to be. And so, it changes the game. But I think we're very well positioned both with the assets we have in spectrum, and with the processes we have in place, to deploy capacity and stay out in front of it. So it's not an overwhelming concern for us. We, I think, are well prepared to continue down this path.
And now that you've won FirstNet, how quickly can we expect you to deploy the WCS and AWS-3 spectrum, which you already had, as well as the 700 MHz spectrum you're receiving from FirstNet? And more broadly, how long do you expect your current spectrum holdings to be able to support the growth in traffic and capacity that you're expecting?
Well, spectrum is a very local business in that every market is slightly different and unique in its characteristics. But if I were to generalize, I would say roughly we have now with the win of FirstNet, we have 60 MHz of deployable spectrum. And there are economies now that we are embarking on this unlimited phase in the industry that we're going to be out there touching. So there's an economy to go deploy all of that at once. And that's the intention that we have. We'll deploy 700 that came from FirstNet, the WCS, and the AWS spectrum in each of the markets we go in all at the same time.
And As it relates to the 60 megahertz that you have and that we're in an unlimited world now, is that going to be enough, do you believe, to support us for the next several years in terms of what you're going to need to continue to offer an unlimited product and continue to maintain the quality of the network?
Yeah. I think that when you look back at the AWS 3 auction and our strategy there, and you look at FirstNet and our strategy there, we thought that it was vital that we have that runway that runs from today through 2020, where we had visibility, known spectrum. We had a deployment strategy that would allow for explosive growth. The acceleration of that with the unlimited programs that are out there now doesn't change the overall thesis. The video usage on the mobile network has been operating in a really rapid growth trajectory for quite some time now. That was our strategy all along, is to ensure that we had sufficient spectrum runway, because the most effective way to deploy capacity is with spectrum.
Maybe just before we go a little bit further, can you just quickly describe to the audience what FirstNet is and what just happened there?
Well, the government has been working for years and years to design a first responders network. With that, they had allocated spectrum, 20 megahertz of spectrum in the 700 band. Working through a design of what that network would look like. The request for proposal that came from the FirstNet organization was really a public-private partnership, but also a dedicated commercial prioritization scheme that I think was an extremely clever way to approach the problem of getting interoperability for all the first responders nationally. We were delighted to have been selected to partner with the government, and we're now working through the process of putting together state plans and working our way towards getting the states in a position to evaluate the program.
I believe you'll be posting the plans in June. I think they go out to the governors June 19th. Any sense at this—
Give or take a day?
Give or take a day.
Yeah.
Well, that came from FirstNet, who said that at WIA last week.
I'm just kidding.
Any sense at this juncture how many states you expect will participate, or maybe ask differently, why a state might elect not to sign up?
Well, if you look at the needs of the first responder, we think that FirstNet did an excellent job of understanding what would be the criteria that a state would use to evaluate being in. It's coverage, it's reliability, it's not only in a normal state of affairs, but in an emergency. How does capacity get consumed in the network? What features do you need to ensure that the first responders get the prioritization on the network? I think once the states have an opportunity to evaluate in totality what it means to be in and what would be necessary to be out, I think it's a very compelling proposition for the states to join. We expect that most, if not all, will, and we believe that we're going to have a very compelling case for them.
When would the build commence? I know you have 5 years to build out for FirstNet, but realistically, what would you like to see happen?
Well, it's a milestone-based program, and so we're going to move as fast as we can. We started earlier this year in doing the planning for it so that when the award would be made, we'd be ready to move extremely quickly. A lot of the things that you need from a software perspective are already in the process of production. We think by the end of this year, we're going to have features for the states that will allow them to opt in even before the 700 megahertz spectrum is deployed. They'll have an opportunity to get on our commercial network and have features like ruthless preemption, which is when all heck is breaking loose and there's a need for a first responder to get a channel on the network, they'll get that prioritization to get them that channel. As early as 2017, the minute they're ready, we're going to have some features that will provide them benefits immediately.
So the network build-out for FirstNet could start as early as late this year, post awaiting until 2018.
That's correct.
And then from a CapEx perspective, your CFO, John Stevens, has indicated that you guys could be at the higher end of your $22 billion range this year, in part because of FirstNet. Do you think that we're going to remain at an elevated level through the next few years as we get this network built out?
On a gross basis, well, there's going to be a build-out. The capital program will increase. On a net basis, the capital intensity won't rise because of the nature of the reimbursement that comes from FirstNet for the
$6.5
billion.
$6.5 billion,
right. So, the upward bias for this year is really a deployment reimbursement timing kind of issue.
And just to sum up on FirstNet before we move on to another topic, how big of a deal then was FirstNet for AT&T? And when you think of the other companies that may have been bidding for that as well, what competitive position does this put you in?
Oh my goodness, it's like the engineers are in charge again. When you think about how we've been deploying, we've had a theoretical advantage with spectrum. And that theoretical advantage is converting now to a practical advantage with this deployment strategy. And so what FirstNet has allowed us to do is it's unlocked an opportunity for us to get a very economical way to deploy all of the spectrum that's out there. And it also, though, has an opportunity for us to get our white space in coverage cared for. And so our network is now going to be more comprehensive, faster, and more reliable. So for the engineer in me, the network side of things, it really is a great opportunity for us to take our wireless network to the next level.
So to put words in your mouth, you have 40 megahertz of spectrum that was sitting by itself that you would have loved to deploy. You're now getting an additional 20, but there's a cost to deploying that first 40 megahertz.
Uh-huh.
You now effectively have a partner who's going to financially enable you to do that all in one fell swoop, which is going to give you the capacity so that if we are competing in an unlimited world, you're going to be able to keep up with that, perhaps more so than your competitors.
Correct. Okay. Absolutely.
Want to shift over to millimeter wave spectrum.
Sure.
So you recently bought millimeter wave spectrum with your acquisition of Fiber Tower, and recently lost out on a bidding war for Straight Path. Do you consider millimeter wave spectrum the next beachfront spectrum? And in what function do you expect to utilize the millimeter wave spectrum you received with Fiber Tower?
Several questions nested in there. Increasingly, spectrum is becoming real estate, and it's harder to discern beachfront versus the stuff that you have here in the city that just faces the next building. And that is because once you have your coverage layer set, the economics of your footprint get established. And so now you start to think about what's best for carrying video, what's best for the cheapest equipment, the economics. And so what's important about millimeter wave is it's the launch spectrum for 5G. And 5G as a network is the most amazing technology that I've seen in like my whole career. Maybe IP is on par with it, but few other things. And so it was important to us to get spectrum to launch 5G, to be in the early 5G game. And so that's what Fiber Tower afforded us the opportunity to get launch spectrum. Now, we're going to want to augment that with some additional spectrum for capacity in millimeter wave over time. But there is a spectrum auction planned from the FCC. There'll be aftermarket opportunities, we think, as well.
So you're going to be utilizing the millimeter wave spectrum for 5G intentions. This isn't, and I think, and so two things. One is that you're not intending to use that for wireless backhaul, which is how this type of spectrum has been used historically speaking. And then secondly, this is more around mobile solutions opposed to fixed wireless. Is that fair?
Well, it's not entirely accurate in that there's something that's very different about 5G than the industry's ever done before. Historically in the industry, we went into a standards process so that we could interoperate, so that, you know, cell phones would hand calls from tower to tower, that AT&T could hand off to Verizon and T-Mobile and Sprint and vice versa. And so those processes tended to take years as specifications got written. What's different in 5G is it's being written in two tranches. The first tranche, the first release, is for fixed. And so it defines the radio access network so that that innovation can happen, and that's predominantly for fixed. And then the subsequent release of the standard would include mobility, handoffs, the interoperability sorts of things. And so it's been broken into two releases. And so the first release is one that everybody wants to be involved in because this technology is so transformative. And so we're in that game, and we stood up trials last year in Austin, and we're in several other locations now. We've started to look at specific use cases. We're looking at DirecTV and a video delivery product. We're also doing some point-to-point for enterprises, sort of a think of it as a campus environment. And those will be important use cases early, and we're learning. You know, one of the things you trial is you trial for the technology, and we're really happy with where we are. We're getting 14 gig at 3 milliseconds of latency. That's stunning. That's real time. That's faster than perception for you. And so, you know, so technology right on track. Then you look at it and say, what else do you learn in the trial? Well, you learn things like, do I have to dispatch a technician? How big is the form factor? Can I put it inside the building? Does it have to be outside the building? And those are the things that we're going to be learning throughout the remainder of this year and into next year, so we get our entire deployment strategy. And so we want to be involved early and often, as they say, in all of the use cases that are going to be out there for 5G.
There's a good amount of people in the industry that remain skeptical about the use of millimeter wave. What do you think is not being appreciated, or it's being discounted by those who might be feeling that way, thinking about this maybe how we thought about 10 years ago?
Well, it's a mesh technology, and so I think a lot of folks think of millimeter wave for its short propagation characteristics. But, you know, as you start to think about how you would deploy it into buildings and so on, it's going to be deployed more like Swiss cheese, and that's different than, I think, some of the historical ways that deployments have happened. But I'll remind you, in that second release of 5G, we're going to have it working on all the spectrum bands that are out there. So, you know, it's going to affect the entire network ultimately.
You know, you and I talked about something last night where 5G is going to be deployed differently than how we thought about 2G, 3G, and 4G, kind of from the inside out. Maybe you could kind of talk about how you guys are seeing that.
Yeah, and so that fits very well with the concept of, you know, of this gig zones, as you think about it. And so you look at high consumption zones in the outdoors. That will be a really good use case for this. But then another one that's very good is, you know, where you would go point to point and then distribute it locally with Wi-Fi, for instance. And so, you know, the analogy I always use is that the industry grew up where we were lighting buildings from the parking lot. We were beaming signals 8 miles to go make connections. And so the smaller footprint isn't that troublesome, because every day as the consumption in a wireless network goes up and up and up and up, it makes more sense to do things from the inside out. And so we light the building from the inside, not from the parking lot. And so the denser the network over time, the more practical that is.
There's three attributes that's being talked about with 5G right now. One is enhanced mobile broadband, or effectively making things faster in terms of megabits per second.
Yep.
The second one is massive machine-type communications, or the enablement of IoT. And then the last one is ultra-reliable and low-latency communications, sub-10 milliseconds, maybe sub-5 milliseconds. Of those factors, what do you think are going to be the most game-changing, and how does somebody like AT&T participate in that revenue opportunity?
Yeah, so you missed two of them. There's two others that not a lot of people are talking about. One is that it's software-defined from the beginning. That's a radically different thing. And for AT&T as the leader in software-defined networking, that's crucial. And then the last one is it's going to have in-band telemetry. So it's going to have tremendous big data capabilities for how we manage the network. So if you go back to year three, sort of, throughput and latency, while the glamour shot is always what's the speed, I think the game changer in 5G is the latency because real-time networks change everything. So let me just give you an example. If you're going to do an autonomous car, you're making a decision right now about where am I going to control the car from? The trade-off is, do I want to do it from a live map and the map is the control? Do I want to do it from the network? Which things do I do from the network? And so a simple example is that if I go kick over one of those orange barrels that's out on the street and it's in the street, the first autonomous car that comes up there has a problem. And then now that problem has to be dealt with for the entire network so that routes change. And so there is a central function and a local function. Now, if you say the network is real-time, then you can start to move those decisions out of the car and put them into the network. And so how maps get structured, how autonomous cars get control, changes. Same with virtual reality. Virtual reality, if you have to rearrange all your furniture in your house and tether yourself to a machine, that evolution of moving from that to a power pack in your pocket, when you get a 5G network, virtual reality can not only be outdoors, you can have very small form factors because you can do a lot of that compute in the network. And so real-time here is about architectural shifts to everything we're touching.
I think just to use the car example, the benefit there would be rather than having a lot of sophisticated equipment in the car, which would be expensive and per car, you could ultimately have that placed in the network once, which would be very cost savings, I would think, to those that are building out these solutions. And then part of that would be that you're having some of that compute, if you will, being done on the edge, which is part of that, I think, the mobile edge compute portion of 5G. And some of that's actually still going to be done in the core.
Yeah, so let me give you some perimeter math, if you will, in networking. If you think about our big data centers, think of, give or take, 40 data centers. And then you think about 4,600 central offices. And then you think about 70,000 cell sites. And then you think about 400,000 in-network terminals. Those are all positions, real estate positions with connectivity positioning that allows us to fundamentally rethink where we put things. So the network itself moves from a connection to an experience that can include compute, for instance. And so what we've thought of as the network will evolve. And so I realize I'm kind of on the back of 5G here, so we're a few years out. But I think it fundamentally reshapes the configuration of networks and what we think of as a network.
Part of 5G is obviously small cells. How quickly does AT&T need to start building that out, and where are you today in that development?
Yeah, this year we'll deploy thousands, and what we want to do is we want to gain the experience. There are certain spots in our network that are ideal for it. There are certain locations that we've tagged as ones that we think we need to be early in to gain right of way. So we're prudently saying, what do we have to do this year? And it numbers in the few thousand. And then you look at that over time. When do you want to deploy? Well, you want to deploy as late as possible where you get favorable economics. So our strategy overall is to take advantage of the spectrum, take advantage of our tower density at 70,000, do small cells to supplement that, and get our cost of small cell deployment as low as possible, do it as late as possible, and then ramp to the speed that you need.
So compared to others out there that might be talking more aggressively about rolling out small cells today, when you think of the opportunity tied to 5G, you still think of that as still several years out, at least on the mobile side. And from that perspective, you're willing to wait to build out in an aggressive manner, thinking that over the next several years, the cost of building those small cells will come down.
Correct. And I think that, you know, we have a fiber footprint and right of way access footprint that makes us not feel terribly nervous about that strategy.
I want to shift over and talk about towers.
Sure.
So at another conference recently, when referring to macro towers, Bill Hogg said AT&T has found new suppliers with a new business model that is more sustainable, and that AT&T is talking to existing suppliers to embrace this model. Can you explain what you want to see reworked with the current tower operators that you're working with, and perhaps shed some light on the magnitude of towers you're looking to see these changes made at?
Well, I think that the structure of the tower industry now, if I could draw an analogy, it's like we rent an apartment, and then I'm charged every time I take an appliance into the apartment and plug it in. That's not really tied to the economics of the industry that we're in. And so what we're really after is more of a model that's, you know, square footage, square inch based, more of a real estate model as opposed to a technology or a touch model. And so, as Bill pointed out rightfully, the model that exists today isn't sustainable for the industry. And so we are looking at alternative suppliers. As we build going forward, we're gonna do a lot of our own building where it's economical, and then we're just looking to bend that curve.
In terms of, when you say building on your own, are you willing to get back into the tower business yourself, or are you speaking more from the perspective you want to use new third parties to help build those towers for you?
Either one. A lot of the tower companies' purchases in the first place were to buy towers that we had built. One of our core competencies as a company is building networks. Got 142 years of experience doing that. And so we're good builders, and we're gonna go build. And so, you know, we don't want to say we're gonna do all of anything, because there are situations where we'll go to third parties for a build. There's some where we will attach to existing towers, where we think that they have the right economics, and then there's some where we'll build ourselves.
You did a sale-leaseback with Crown Castle a few years ago, and if I remember correctly, that's with a 2% escalator, and you effectively get free touches on the tower. I think you have two cell sites, so effectively no amendments required, no amendment revenue. Is that a good model for what you're trying to get to?
Yes. And when we did that, we contemplated these touches, and so, you know, that was a structure that I think works for us.
Based on the requirements for FirstNet, it sounds like you'll have to start rolling out as early as late this year. And considering your one-touch approach, a lot of these decisions are gonna have to be figured out shortly. With that said, is there enough time for you to be in a strong position to negotiate with the towers to get what you want and still meet the requirements that you need to for FirstNet?
Yeah, we're confident we can pull that off.
And then the last question on this is, based on the conversations you're having with your current tower partners, how likely do you think it is that they're gonna meet the demands, or you're gonna be able to come to an agreement with them around the terms that you're looking for them to change?
You know, we've been in discussions with the major tower companies for months now, and, you know, we're optimistic.
I want to shift over to SDN and NFV. AT&T has been a leader in SDN and NFV, and today, I believe about 34% of your network functions are virtualized, and you're on pace for 55% by year-end. How responsible are these initiatives for the improvements we've seen in wireline margins of late, and how much more savings can we expect to see from these initiatives?
Well, I think John Stephens has talked the last several earnings calls about the trajectory, and so we're very confident that we have a sustainable program here. Software-defined networking, the hardest part of your program is on anything that you do technologically is the 5%-30%, because that's where you've got to get your economics worked out, that's where you've got to get your processes worked out, and that's what's gonna drive your efficiency. And so for us in software-defined networking, last year was that year. We went from 6% to 34%. And so this year, getting 34, going from 34 to 55, which we're on track to do, seems like a formidable task, but I always tell my team this year is easier than last year. So I think we've hit the tipping point, is what I'm saying. Is by the end of this year, we're going to be doing more things in software than we are the old way. And so there's really no return. So our operational processes move from blended to transformed. And that's really a big part of this is capital is far more efficient. And we've been getting the last 5 years when you look at our cost per gig carried, we've actually beat Moore's Law. And the only way to beat Moore's Law is to get out of the silicon and get into software. And so, you know, when we look back over the last 30 years, for 25 of those 30 years, we didn't keep pace with compute or software development or storage or Moore's Law. So networking was the laggard here. And so the last 5 years at AT&T, the software-defined networking has been transformative in not only the economics that you point out, but it has us in this curve of speed that we're just faster at deploying capacity, we're faster at how we manage the business, and when you're faster, you're more efficient. Time is a silent
cost. What's been the response from the OEMs that you're working with and those that have historically been implanted in that network? Are they falling in line with where you need them to go?
I think that the trauma's over. I think that the spectrum was everything from sheer delight to sheer terror. But I think it's no longer this mythical, spooky thing. And the resistance of can it work, those sorts of things are behind us. And in order to do that, we had to develop a lot of what were OEM products ourselves. And it wasn't because we wanted to go back to the Western Electric days. It was because we had to show them it could be done and then go back into those same supply chain folks and have them build from that. So we've done a lot of work self-perform in software the last 5 years, and we've pushed most of it into open source, as you've seen. We put one of the biggest projects ever landed in open source, we put out a few months ago in the Linux Foundation, which is basically the network operating system. We wrote an operating system for all of networking and then gave it away. And so for my own team internally, you know, imagine that there's a few crazy moments where I'm with my own team. One of them is I said, if people are going to believe us, I'm going to start putting your compensation metrics out in public. So there aren't many people who, like when we say we're going from 34 to 55, we're calling our shots, January, February, March, we're calling our shots on all the major stuff so that the whole industry can look at it, so OEMs can look at it. And then the other thing is the day that I told them we have to innovate faster than others can copy, because in order for this to work, we're going to have to give a bunch of our work away. And that's what we've been doing.
On the product side, you've developed the NetBomb product, now more recently FlexWare, leveraging the SDN and NFV platform. First off, can you talk to us about what FlexWare is, since that's the newer of the two? And then secondly, what are some of the other initiatives we could see coming out of AT&T because of this move to a software-defined network?
Well, FlexWare is, if you think of it, it's an app store for enterprises that does networking. And that's the only apps you have. So you have a white box piece of hardware, and you need a firewall, and you can drag and drop a firewall. You need a voice over IP service, you can drag and drop one. You need a WAN accelerator, you can drag and drop one. And so it literally takes on-premise networking for enterprises and makes it like an app store, except it's what used to be major appliances that got racked and stacked are now just software. And that's what FlexWare is. FlexWare is not only networking, it's the ancillary functions that a network needs beyond a carrier environment on a simple to consume software model.
And then I just want to shift over and talk about Project AirGig, since we only have about 3 minutes left.
Sure.
So Project AirGig, you're calling it one of the most ambitious and inventive projects in AT&T Labs history, which is obviously a very bold statement considering everything Labs has invented. Help us understand what Project AirGig is exactly and how game-changing this could be.
Yeah. Well, Project AirGig is a wireless signal that propagates alongside or on a power cable, not through. And that's the thing not a lot of people understand, is that we are using plastic components that are super inexpensive and launching a signal that goes a very long distance, very reliably, at a very high speed, along or adjacent to a power line. And so for us, it's a game changer on a cost basis because the components are small, simple, and plastic. Performance-wise, it's got extraordinary capabilities. And so we're going to be in trials this year. So it's a real thing. We're going to have to work through, you know, we know the technology works. What we need to understand is, you know, how does it work in the field? What's our design criteria for things like how long how far down a wire can we reliably propagate? But that would basically say broadband infrastructure is deployable at affordable rates everywhere there is above ground power, which is pretty profound.
So where would you deploy this technology, and how pervasive do you think it ultimately could be then?
Mexico, rural areas. It can be used for front haul, back haul, for 5G. It can be used as a point to point. So it has a lot of use cases. We're going to look in the trials here. We're going to go into rural areas because one of the earliest use cases we'd like to see it applied into is a replacement for some of the legacy broadband we have that's ADSL, that's really expensive to go upgrade.
Just my last question, and really for the entire conversation, does this work with fiber or does this replace fiber in some situations?
It would augment a fiber deployment, but what it would be unique. It's not you need fiber and this. So the way we think about it is we need to evolve our entire network to a gig. So we're looking at G.dot fast for apartments. We're looking at 5G fixed, as we talked about earlier. We're looking at fiber to the home. We're looking at an air gig. So we're taking our entire footprint, and we're trying to maximize the solution set we have so we can serve every customer the most economical way possible with a gig and low latency. And that's the objective we have. It's going to take years to get there, but we're going to press every one of those dimensions because there's no one access technology that we think is going to carry the day and win and be ubiquitous.
Gotcha. With that, we're out of time. So thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Colby.